break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is New York Times columnist David Carr. His new memoir about his experiences with drug addiction is called The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. Well, David Carr, you were with a number of women in this period of your life. You were apparently a charming guy. Tell us about Anna, the mother of your twins. What kind of person she was?
Anna was a smart, tough cookie from northern Minnesota. Got a lot of bad breaks in terms of her upbringing. And one of the things, her adaptive characteristic was to get involved in selling drugs. She was very good at it. When I met her, she was moving a kilo a month of pressed cocaine. And she had a weakness for losers, and that would have been me. And she tried to enroll me sort of in the business at hand, and we ended up sort of finding each other in weakness. In other words, I lost my job. I was a very successful, award-winning journalist at the time, and she was somebody who was making a lot of money buying and selling drugs to the elite of the city we lived in Minneapolis, and probably within a year of getting together, we had both lost our respective gigs and were pretty much at bottom. And then I found out that Anna was pregnant. Pretty clear signal from God that it's time to straighten out some lifestyle issues, but that didn't happen. My kids were born 2.5 months premature and were in the neonatal intensive care unit at the University of Minnesota for 30 days. And when they came out, I don't think either Anna or I were capable as parents. I mean, they lived with us. We got by after a fashion, but it was clear after a while that the center would not hold.
And when did you know that you had to do something and get yourself into a program?
There was this night when Anna was busy, she was out somewhere, and I was at home, and I was watching the girls, and they were probably, 8 or 9 months. And I was out of drugs, and I was not the kind of person that would leave them home, but I needed to go somewhere. So they came with me, and I left them parked in the car while I went inside for what was supposed to be 5 minutes. And probably turned out to be more like 2 hours. And when I came out, I didn't really know what I would find in that car. You know, two babies alone in a crummy part of the city, cold night, tucked in their snowsuits. And I opened up the door and I could see their breath. And I just, you know, if there's any kind of moment, that was when I just said, you know, I've been a bad husband. I had been married earlier in life. I never married Anne. I had been a bad sibling. I had been a bad son. I had been a bad employee. There was nothing really in my upbringing that suggested it'd be okay to be a bad father. I was raised well by wonderful parents, and I just got a clear feeling that I was up to something that God would not easily forgive.
So you left the kids with your parents and made your way into rehab, which was a long road. You point out the importance of time and getting out of it. You know, there's a point where you have 12 rules for recovery, not the, you know, the 12 steps that one hears of. But one of them was to go into a rehab place that you never, ever want to go back to. Avoid treatment centers with duck ponds, good food, or a record of admitting Britney Spears. What was your rehab center like?
Eaton House, it's still there, 1025 Portland Avenue, low bottom, meaning people probably dually diagnosed with what would be called MICD, where they're mentally incompetent, chemically dependent. Most of the place was criminal justice referrals, so it was people coming out of county jails, state prisons, and some of them were gaming and trying to find a way to shorten their sentence. Some of the people were really actually done, but it was like a house full of 60 knuckleheads. There were, I ended up in charge with the basement, in charge of the kitchen, and there were rats in the basement. Not like abundant, like any sort of old city building, but I have to admit that just absolutely terrified me to go down there in the morning to open up the kitchen. And I, you know, I don't want to pretend like it was Abu Ghraib, but it was a very serious place full of very serious people, and sort of the soft white boy from the suburbs who used to be a journalist, who had self-invented as some kind of half-cocked gangster. I didn't get a lot of play there, I gotta say. they were not impressed by me.
You were not the tough guy on the block, huh?
No, I was not. I was an easy mark. But I found real friends in there, friends I have to this day. And it's the kind of place where they have all sorts of goofy slogans, like the answer to life is learning to live. And, you know, when I woke up this morning, I was having a really difficult day today. And there I was saying the goofy slogan from Eden House from Umpty Ump years ago. The weird thing about all those aphorisms and slogans, millions and millions of people have used them to stay alive. So, you know, I have no, I think you have to be absolutely frantically earnest to find recovery. I went through four treatments sort of motoring along on cynicism and irony. And you know what? Doesn't usually turn out that well.
Right. So you got out and managed to stay clean and take care of these twins and begin your journalistic career, which I want to talk about. How did Anna fare, the mother of the twins?
Anna did okay. She was in short-term hospital treatment, 28 days, came out, was sober for a while. But, you know, I had grown up and I had a craft. I was a journalist and I could find work right away. Her whole history was that she had been involved in the drug lifestyle. And so to make money, she necessarily ended up back with those same folks. And it isn't long before you're going to succumb to the abundant blandishments of that lifestyle. And so I went to pick up the kids one time, and they were wet and tired and hungry. And I took them to 7-Eleven, got them bottles and bananas, and stood in the parking lot and thought, you know what? I'm not going to bring them back.
Tell us about rebuilding your journalistic career. I mean, you had long had a knack for this. You say even when you were using, you went after crooked politicians and stories of trends and social issues in Minneapolis. How long did it take you to get back into being a real successful working journalist?
Well, Dave, you're a journalist, and so you know there is something obsessive and frantic about wanting to know. And so it wasn't like it was a terrible fit to begin with.
Right.
Part of the reason I probably sobered up is I couldn't stand being out of the game. I love writing. I love reporting. And I was in the position of seeing as my whole support system as a single parent of twin baby girls, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was pretty much stuck in Minneapolis, and that meant, well, I was going to work for every single editor that I had kind of screwed over when I was flopping around as an addict. And the trouble with that is, even when you are sincere and you are for real, you're just saying the things that you said the last time around, which is, I'm better, things are going well, I'm going to meetings, everything's great. And then you face plant. And so even though I knew I was back and I knew I was for real, there was no different rhetorical set to really use on people.
But you got a job at a weekly in Minneapolis editing the paper, right, doing well there, and then ended up in Washington at City Paper, right?
Yep.
Learned to run a staff and help other people do good stories, not just do them yourself. How did you get to the New York Times?
I wonder that sometimes, too, when I walk in there and I wonder if my, like, I'll be traveling on a story and I'll see my luggage bag around, I'll see that tag on my bag and think some horrendous mistake has been made. When I got my job there, my dad said, "Well, David, you've always wanted to work at the New York Times." And I said, "Dad, I've never said that in my life. New York Times is one of humankind's greatest creations. And even though the majesty of it is not always apparent from within, everybody there is trying real hard to make it good. And it's a spectacular work environment in that way. I came to New York, worked for a dot-com run by Kurt Anderson and Michael Hirschhorn, Deanna Brown, called Inside.com, and went to work at The Atlantic and New York. And I got a call to be a business reporter and cover publishing at the New York Times. And I was skeptical at first, but I had never worked at a daily in my life. I sort of thought a guy should give this a whirl if he's got a shot. I think part of the reason I got hired there is I'd been covering publishing and entertainment on and off for different publications in the city. And even though I sort of fell off a turnip truck and didn't really know anybody and know what I was doing, I fumbled my way to a few decent stories. I'm clearly a productive writer. I'm a person who works a lot, and I'm comfortable in a variety of voices covering a variety of topics. So that makes me a decent tool to have in the belt.
David Carr's new book is The Night of the Gun. He'll be back in the second half of the show. You can read an excerpt of the book or listen to some of the interviews Carr recorded at our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose four-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org. And from Dial Press, publisher of The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society, by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows, about friendship and the power of the written word. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Geddes joins us to talk about being part of Iraq's Invisible Army. Geddes spent time as a military contractor there. He writes about his experiences in the memoir Highway to Hell. And we continue our conversation with David Carr, who used reporter skills to reconstruct his lost years as a crack addict. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross, back with New York Times columnist David Carr. He used his reporting skills to reconstruct his former life as a crack addict in a memoir called The Night of the Gun. In your book, The Night of the Gun, you use first names for everybody, including in describing your experience at the Times, a reporter named Jason, who ends up getting into trouble for making stuff up.
Jason Blair.
Yeah, we're talking about Jason Blair here, obviously. And he ends up, you end up popping up in his book at a moment when his deceit is all crashing down upon him. Describe that moment, if you would.
Well, I mean, like a lot of people, I really liked Jason. Jason was an extremely charming young man, still is. I don't stay in regular touch with him, but it's so funny, given my background and the amount of sort of pathology I've rubbed up against in my life, that Jason totally got over on me, that I was his last and most stalwart defender, and everyone else had to be crazy, and this, it couldn't have been. I can remember a friend of mine, Eric Wemple at the Washington City Paper, called me and said, now runs it, and says, you know what, these stories are bad. They're bad all the way through, bad to the bone. And I just said, you got it all wrong. And it turned out that Jason had, for reasons I still can't fathom, I don't think he would be able to explain, he more or less wound a rope around his neck and then tied it around our feet, everyone else who was there, and then just like jumped off a cliff. And when it all came crashing down, I felt that Jason, who had a history of drug use, was just going to leave the Times and go west into the projects where he used to cop and probably never come back again. And regardless of what you think of what he did, and I find what he did to be reprehensible and appalling in all regards, because I value so much this thing of ours. But as a human being, and that was the concern of the leadership, Gerald Boyd, now deceased, managers who said, go out and find that kid, find out what he is doing. And I walked up to him and I gave him a speech, and it was full of all kind of program claptrap and recovery stuff and the things that you say to people when they're in a desperate circumstance. And the weirdest thing was, when his book came out, that whole speech was there, word for word, as I had said it. And I thought to myself, well, if you could do that on the worst day of your life, remember a 200, 300-word speech that a colleague gave you on a street corner, how is it that you couldn't just go and do the news stories? Hmm. What was so hard about that?
You know, I wanted to ask, you know, part of the premise of your book is that a story of addiction and recovery, which, as you said, has been written many times before.
And some of it really grand and wonderful, you know, right. And I tried not to read those books before I got started.
Huh. Why not? You wanted to
just because, you know, you're sort of living the cliche. It's not enough that you spent so much time with your life wrapped around, you know, your lips wrapped around a bottle or a crack pipe or God knows what. It's now that you've finally sobered up, why not just shut up about it and get on with it? Why do you have to squeeze something else out of it?
And what's your answer to that?
My answer is that after 14 years sober from very low bottom, I sobered up. I got custody of my twins. I got them off welfare. I got cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma. As a single parent, survived, prospered, kept my job, ended up running newspapers, met a wonderful woman, married her, had a wonderful kid, and after 14 years of all these promises sort of piling up around me, I decided to pour whiskey on it and give it a try, give being a suburban drunk a try. And it didn't go very well. It lasted about 2.5 years. I got arrested for drunk driving. And about 6 months after it happened, I really needed to write a book. I had kids going to college. And I thought to myself, you know, for me to do what I did, I've done a lot of forgetting. I don't think if I ever knew who I was, I had forgotten who I was. And worse things could happen for me and for the other people who might read this than for me to go back and look at what happened. And it's been a nice thing for my health.
You know, I guess one of the things that I wondered was, when one writes a memoir of addiction and recovery solely from their memory, then they're, as you noted, probably getting some very inaccurate stuff, memories, the version that they wanted to hear, and not remembering things that are simply clouded by their substance abuse. When you do it more thoroughly, as you did, and interview people and go through documentary evidence and really try to reconstruct it honestly, do you think the story is fundamentally different? Are there different lessons that you learn from a more...
Wow, what a cool question. I love that. Because the baseline story is the same. You know, I was normal, then I drank or did drugs, then I lost my mind, then I sobered up, now everything is new again. So whether you're sitting in your basement typing about that or going and talking to people, here are some things that I found out. One of the things I found out is it's a tenet of recovery that you must always recover for yourself. Well, I never managed that until I had two sort of defenseless children in my life and they needed parenting. So regardless of what the cliche said, in my own instance, I needed to come to grips with, you know, yes, I'd like to feed the monster, but I'm not willing to destroy children to do it. The other thing is recovery narratives are often writ in personal heroic terms where you, like the story I told standing there with the snowsuits and deciding, well, I'm never going to be this man again. Hey, guess what? My parents were there to take the kids. They put them in temporary foster care with Patrick and Zelda. They looked after them. When I had cancer, my sister came over every single day because I couldn't stand to have anybody else in the house. This whole cliche of the village pulling and lifting the fabric, the fact that we're all in this together, became so manifest in the reporting because when people would talk to me, a lot of times the talk would turn away from me and turn to the people around me, the people who lifted me and pulled me at every single turn. And I think you forget that. I think people who make it to the other side seem to think that they had a moment of clarity and then everything was made new again. Didn't happen that way.
Well, David Carr, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was an absolute pleasure.
New York Times columnist David Carr. His memoir of addiction and recovery is called The Night of the Gun. A reporter investigates the darkest story of his life, his own. Coming up, a memoir from a mercenary in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. For many Americans, the image of private military contractors in Iraq has been shaped by the fatal shooting of 17 Iraqi civilians last year by employees of Blackwater Worldwide, which had been engaged by the State Department to protect diplomatic personnel. That incident is now the subject of a grand jury investigation in Washington. For years, contractors held immunity from prosecution in Iraq, but that's likely to change as the United States and Iraq negotiate a new security agreement. My guest, John Geddes, worked for years as a military contractor in Iraq, usually providing security for business people and journalists as they traveled about the country and held meetings or covered stories. Geddes is a former British paratrooper who saw action in the Falklands and other conflicts. He says his operation was very different from large American firms like Blackwater. Geddes says he did his best to maintain friendly relations with Iraqis. He kept a low profile and tried to keep his clients, many of them TV journalists, out of dangerous situations. But that wasn't always possible. Geddes carried an AK-47 and fired it more than once to defend his charges. He's written a book about his experiences called Highway to Hell, Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq. Well, John Geddes, welcome to Fresh Air. Besides escorting crews while they're actually shooting news stories, you often had to transport them hundreds of miles. And you tell a harrowing story of taking a news crew from Jordan to Baghdad, I believe. And as you were out there on the open road, a car pulled out and obviously had menacing intentions. It looked like they wanted to perhaps kidnap your crew. What happened?
I picked up a couple of what I call combat indicators, Dave, which is, you know, changes in the atmosphere. Vehicles were starting to pull away, slow down, move away from us. And then this 7 Series pulled up to the rear. It was a black vehicle, blacked out windows. And it was pretty obvious that they meant some kind of derogatory business. Pulled up, the left side window pulled down, and out came an AK-47, put a burst of fire across the front of the vehicle.
Across your vehicle, right?
Yeah, across the bonnet, clipped the light, and obviously with the intention of pulling us over.
So when they fire at the vehicle and or across the front of the vehicle, does your driver slow down, speed up? What do you want him to do at that moment?
Well, previously to that, the crew, after a heavy night of drinking in Jordan, in the Intercontinental, the crew were asleep in the back prior to the gunshots. As soon as they opened up, the driver started slowing down.
Your driver,
I
you
told
mean?
Him, yeah. I told him in no uncertain terms with a few expletives, put your foot down and go. So we carried on. They dropped back momentarily, came back, and both sides of the windows were rolled down, and two AK-47s were pointed at the vehicle at point-blank range. At this stage, I had an AK-47 on my lap and pulled the trigger and fired into their vehicle before they had a chance to take us out.
And that was basically it. And what was the effect of your fire?
Well, it was close quarter. I didn't hang around to find out what damage had occurred, but a burst of armor-piercing rounds at close quarter would cause considerable damage. The car started to fishtail, and I pulled away.
And you fired through your own door, is that right?
Fired through the own door to maintain the element of surprise. Otherwise, as soon as they saw that weapon, we'd have been dead.
How do you feel after an encounter like that?
Pretty shocked. I think, I'm an experienced guy, so it didn't upset me too much initially. It's later on in the day when things unwind that you get a bit of post-trauma stress and need a couple of Jack Daniels at the time to sort my head out. But at the time, I looked back to the crew, who were now awake by this time, and said, you know, welcome to Fallujah.
Oh, boy. And they continued on their way and did their business.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that happens when you're escorting news crews around is that you have to deal with their interest in being aggressive and getting the great camera shot and balancing that against your imperative, which is to keep them safe. How do you deal with that? I mean, were there occasions when camera people wanted to do things that you thought were simply too hazardous or which you accommodated them but worried if you'd let them go too far?
They've got their task. They have their job to do. And the sort of working parameters of that are very delicate, you know. Like you say, Dave, there has to be a balance brought where you can successfully protect a client and they can get their story. So when a journalist looks through or a cameraman looks through a camera, that's all he can see is through that lens. He doesn't see anything behind him to the left or right. And he's completely unaware of what's going on around him. Having a security guy there or girl gives him the opportunity to literally watch his back and flanks while they get on with their job. But even then, they try and push the parameters.
One of the things you write about in the book is that there was a difference between the British and American contractors' approach to moving around, getting from point A to point B safely in a dangerous environment. How would you describe the difference?
The main difference is the American PSDs.
That's the private security detail?
Yeah. They have a particular method of operation. They've got a particular way they dress and the vehicles they use. I think it's sort of State Department rules and regulations that they have to abide by. And they will travel in Humvees. And they virtually wear everything, even down to the weapon scales of the U.S. Army. But they wear one color camouflage and instead of disruptive pattern material. That's the only overtly physical difference. So they'll travel looking, by all intents and purposes, as a military convoy, whereas we travel as a civilian convoy, civilian vehicles, 4x4s, sometimes armored, sometimes not, and communicate as much as we can with the locals, and try and reduce the risk to the client.
You say that you like to travel low profile. The expression is jingly jangly. What does that mean?
Well, it's traveling in low profile, sort of saloon cars that are adapted for, you know, high speed. They're sometimes armored, sometimes not, and the vehicles are dressed to look like everybody else on the highway, so they look like the locals.
Did you say saloon cars?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, sedans.
Ah. So what does that mean? Odd mismatched paints, some scratches and nicks in the fenders?
Yeah. So no matter what vehicle you're using, whether it's a sedan or a 4x4, then it's, you know, it's not clean on the outside. It's a bit scratched, a bit battered, but mechanically sound, so it can make a quick getaway in the event of a problem. And concealed weapons rather than the vehicle bristling with weapons. So from a distance, you're like everybody else. So you travel from A to B in not truly undercover, but low profile.
You describe one trip that you took from Baghdad to Jordan at which the night before you were to leave, a number of folks in the hotel bar found out you were going and you agreed to bring them along. There were some Japanese tourists and I think a couple of Israeli businessmen, and you agreed to let them ride along with your convoy if they kept up at no charge. And off you go barreling down the road with the Israelis in the rear. They fall behind and sure enough get into trouble. What happens?
They wanted to get back to Jordan. The way they got in was by taxi, and they just didn't want to go back by taxi. The mood of the Fallujah road had changed, as it did on a daily basis. Sometimes it was fairly safe to travel up the road. This day, it wasn't. The intelligence came back that, you know, could be a few problems on the highway. Intelligence reports from the American authorities, from the locals, from the drivers, from the interpreters said, you know, it's not a good day to be on the Fallujah Road.
Mm-hmm. But you're out there anyway, right? And
but we're out there anyway. It's you know, at that time it was running a gauntlet. So the Israelis had asked me to come along. I did attempt to sort of charge them a fee, but you know, at the time I was sort of drinking quite a lot of Jack Daniels and Diet Coke at the time, and at the end of the evening, you know, decided to let them travel on the cavalcade the next morning that was quite quickly growing.
So here you are. You're bombing along this road at high speed with an AK-47 and a hangover, and trying to hope all these vehicles stay together. And you notice that these two Israeli businessmen are not keeping up the pace. They fall behind. And then what happens?
Well, they fell behind. They got pulled over and
pulled over by whom? You know,
pulled over by bandits. Probably bandits. I say in my book. Baathist, bandit, insurgents, who knows, you know, but they were pulled over by armed men and quickly sort of subjected to conditioning, in other words, thrown out the vehicle, thrown on the floor and being searched, obviously find out their identity, see if they're worth anything, do they have anything, take the vehicle, maybe hostages, etc. And the deal was the night before, you know, if anybody falls behind, you know, that's it.
But you didn't just let them go. What did you do?
We pulled over. I got to the back of the vehicle. The offside, I got everybody in a ditch. Got my AK out with the tripod in front of the weapon, put that down. Had a nice sort of fairly accurate times 15 sight on there, and put down a couple of rounds to persuade the aggressors to think again.
Now, when you pulled over, how far away were you from the point where these two Israelis were being captured by these guys?
I think it was probably about 200 meters.
And did the bandits or insurgents, whoever they were, did they realize that you had pulled over and were taking aim at them?
No. It was too much traffic. They didn't know at that time. We were just part of the traffic at that point. It was very heavy traffic at that time.
So how many of them were there, and what did your fire result in?
I identified two, and as far as I could see, I hit at least one of them, and created enough diversion for the second guy to get in his vehicle, which gave the opportunity for the Israelis to extract.
We're speaking with John Geddes. His book is about his experiences as a military contractor in Iraq. It's called Highway to Hell. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is John Geddes. He worked as a military contractor in Iraq. He's written a book called Highway to Hell, Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq. You know, you've described a couple of occasions where you shot and hit Iraqis, probably killed some. What legal consequences, if any, would you face for having shot an Iraqi?
That's quite a question, Dave.
Well, on the occasions when you did fire at someone, did you simply move on? I mean, it was obviously situations of hostile fire. I mean, it wasn't like this was a civilian dispute. Hmm. What were the laws that governed hostilities between private contractors and Iraqis?
Well, the laws that govern sort of private contractors aren't. It's pretty much a gray area. You know, the companies that operate. They have their own. Particularly the British ones. They have their own sort of set code of conduct. They have orders for opening fire, and basically they operate within British Army rules of engagement, not legally but morally, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They're all ex-soldiers, and that's their the standard they work to, and that's the sort of criteria of their standard operating procedures. But as far as accounting for action, there is no authority even today to answer to.
Well, of course, I mean, the incident that is most widely known was September of last year when the American company Blackwater Worldwide had this shootout in a Baghdad traffic circle and killed 17 civilians. And there's an American grand jury looking into that. And as the United States negotiates a new security agreement with Iraq, what I've read is that the immunity that, in effect, has governed contractors will be removed, but it's not so clear what the rules will be. Was it simply unclear what rules, if any, governed your contact with Iraqis then?
Well, it was at that time, it was the law of the gun, really. I was defending myself. I was defending people around me, and against armed insurgents or armed bandits, or whoever they are. being paid to transport people from A to B. Working within my own moral parameters, I can, you know, honestly say that I never fired a weapon without good reason.
You know, you've spent a life in the military and saw action in a lot of places before you became a private contractor. Why did you do what you did in Iraq? Is it the adventure? Is it the money?
Initially, it was the adventure. That's a soldier's lot. That's why people become soldiers, to work and in that environment and ultimately go to war. And there's a certain amount of institutionalization that takes place when you spend so much time with the military. And when it's time to leave, it's a hard transition into civilian life. I found it quite easy until Gulf War II and the sort of specter of the private security company in hostile environments became evident and big business. I just felt I had to get out there to experience the job. More money was pretty secondary, and find out myself what was going on.
You know, pilots in World War II used to, if I know the story correctly, used to have so many missions that they would fly and would look forward to finishing that number of missions, because they knew that the more missions they flew, the longer the odds were that they would go home safely. Do you feel like you've had enough of getting out there and risking your neck, or is that something you want to continue to do?
It's a question I ask myself all the time. It is a law of averages. It is Russian roulette, especially on the streets of Iraq. But it's the way I rationalize it is, you know, if you take a year out, then the credits are back in the books, and you can go out there and do some more.
So you think you'll be back out there with an AK-47 and
most definitely
again?
At some point. Yeah, most definitely.
Well, John Geddes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Geddes' memoir is called Highway to Hell, Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Intense fighting in the Caucasian country of Georgia has dominated the news this week. On the next Fresh Air, why Russia invaded Georgia and what it means for the United States, Russia, and the countries that border the former Soviet power. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Ready, Audrey? Okay. 3, 2, 1. Intense fighting in the Caucasian country of Georgia has dominated the news this week. On the next Fresh Air, why Russia invaded Georgia and what it means for the United States, Russia, and the countries that border the former Soviet power. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.